Production. Recorded live.
Hey, Jay, what's up?
Hey, not much. How are you?
I am feeling pretty good.
Yeah?
I have to say, yes, I've completed my 36 and a half day abstinence program.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's one-tenth of a year.
Mm-hmm.
So now I'm in the retoxification process.
Right on. Excellent. How did you begin this process?
Well, when I got home from work today, I made myself a Campari and soda. And then as I was making dinner, I had a, because it was taking a while, I had a Peroni, which is an Italian beer.
Mm-hmm.
And as we were eating dinner, I had a glass or two of Pinot Noir. We had on the grill a pork tenderloin stuffed with artichoke.
Oh, wow.
And a baked potato. And the Pinot Noir went with that pretty well. And then after dinner, for kind of an aperitif, I had some kind of Italian lemon liqueur and soda water.
Mm-hmm.
Which was nice. And then I decided it was time for some serious drinking. So
myself
a Sazerac, although I didn't have any rye whiskey, so I had to use bourbon, which I hope is acceptable, but whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's time for a nightcap.
Right on. Well, it sounds like you've had a busy day.
Yeah, you know, the sad thing is that through all of that, you know, I kind of copped a mild buzz. That's about it.
Yeah.
Once upon a time in the past, if I'd had that much to drink in an afternoon, I would have been on the floor.
Yeah.
And now it's just kind of like, you know, I guess the lesson there is that alcohol and the drinking of it permanently changes your body chemistry or your neurochemistry.
It does, I assume. I mean, that would explain a lot.
One could only assume. So for a nightcap, I'm having a fine cognac.
Oh, a fine one, huh?
A fine, yes, Hennessy. Mm.
Right on. Excellent.
What about you?
I just kind of got my start. So I'm having a bourbon and diet, you know, the old standby here. You know, you've clearly got me beat on the well-stocked liquor cabinet. I'm lucky to actually, you know, if you'd caught me last night, I would have been improvising something probably involving, you know, rubbing alcohol mixed with, some kind of bitters or something.
That's nice.
Because
I was just curious. Now, this is kind of apropos of almost nothing, but what is your position on beer these days?
I just can't drink beer these days. It's
I had a feeling.
Yeah, it's a rather unfortunate thing. You know, I noticed there was a time back when I lived in Indiana when I was drinking quite a good number of beers, and I lived with a beer aficionado.
Sure.
And
probably your drinking
really,
voice once upon a time.
Yeah, it was something that I consumed with glee.
And then you grew up.
Well, you know, maybe one could say that, but actually more to the point, I maybe just changed out of it. I wouldn't even say grew out of it. I started noticing back when I was living in Indiana that the amount of hops in beer seemed to have a direct correlation to the degree to which I would get sleepy before I would get a buzz. So, you know, really hoppy beers like an India Pale Ale, for example.
Yeah.
You know, I'd drink one and it was time for bed as far as I was concerned. It just made me so sleepy. And so, strangely enough, the only beer that I feel like I can drink these days, unless I really want it to put me to sleep, is the cheapest beer possible. Because, of course, they don't, you know, it's practically just water and alcohol.
Sure.
Yeah, so.
I think of it as improved water.
Right, exactly. That's a good way to put it.
Water. Yeah, exactly. We've come to like those kind of beers as well, at least the kind of light Mexican beers. I always attributed it to living in a hot climate, but maybe it's not strictly speaking that. But I do feel like a lot of people, as they kind of mature in their drinking, kind of do sometimes grow out of beer because I didn't really expect the thing that you said with hops. That did kind of take me by surprise. But nevertheless, I feel like that kind of feeling of like, yeah, you know, it kind of just makes me sleepy and full and bloated.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as, you know, getting a little bit of pleasure out of it, no, not really so much. A lot of people do seem to experience that. I find that I like beer only insofar as it might take the place of food.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think of it sometimes as a course in a meal more than something to drink for recreation.
Yeah. It's sad, though. I mean, I remember I, like you, back when we were living in Indiana, like so many, good, thick, stout beers and stouts and so forth.
Yeah.
And I just don't have as much of a hankering for them anymore.
Yeah, exactly. I remember turning my nose up in a kind of derision toward the kind of beers that I now more often drink. Now I think that I have a, well, I suppose that, to draw a parallel with the kind of music that I like, I've grown to be able to appreciate both the depth and character of a very carefully crafted, characterful beer, as well as the beauties that exist within a mass-produced kind of characterless beer. As a matter of fact, you know, in a kind of strange conjunction of those two themes that I just brought up, this very weekend we're hosting a party here at my house that's a kind of an awareness raiser for this opera company that I'm involved in. And we've got a singer who's going to come sing some opera and that kind of thing. And we got through, you know, the connections that I have, you know, that are so legendary, 7 cases of PBR that we're going to share with our friends so that they can enjoy some PBR and some opera.
Boy, you have just opened up a can of worms there. First of all, what do you mean you're involved with an opera company?
Yeah. I'm actually the vice president of the board of directors of an opera company, if you can believe that shit.
Hey, you know what? I'm the president of a nonprofit, so there.
Yeah. There's probably something that I could say at this point, but I don't know what it would be.
Well, the nonprofit I'm president of doesn't have much to do with opera. But
really? What does it have to do with?
We're advocating and organizing for the building of a greenway. It's kind of a rails to trails project.
Mm-hmm.
Right through the heart of New Orleans, about 3 miles, 3 mile stretch of old abandoned rail line. But
yeah.
That is neither here nor there. What I really want to know is you're having an opera singer come
yeah.
to your house
mm-hmm.
and sing while people are drinking Pabst Blue Ribbon.
Yeah.
Is that correct? Am I missing something?
You know, okay, so here's the deal. In a nutshell, I have I've always thought that people my age and younger have an impression of opera, if they haven't had direct exposure to it, then their impression is probably that it's, well, okay, so there was a guy who the other day, speaking to me in a candid and non-critical and honest moment, said to me, you know, I've always thought that opera was something that people went to because they thought it was something they were supposed to like, and not because anybody actually liked it.
Right.
And I actually could feel his pain in a way. You know, I felt that way about it for years before I had a. What's that?
But you kept after it. That's the strange thing.
Well, I didn't actually. The thing that turned my mind around was, I think it was after I quit the music school. I was studying classical percussion, but even when I was doing that, I hated opera. My interest in classical music was there, but it wasn't. It didn't extend to opera, and it wasn't even that intense. You know, this was in the 80s, and so I was more into, you know, like U2 and the Talking Heads. But do you remember Michelle from the dorm?
Been thinking about Michelle a lot lately.
Yeah, I've been trying to figure out what her last name was. I can't remember.
I don't think she had a last name.
Yeah, I know. But she was a wonderful person. She was one of my favorite people in the world from that time period.
Yeah,
and
I saw a picture of her, too. Anyway.
Oh, well.
You can hear her there.
Well, if anybody who's listening to this knows who we're talking about, let us know. But anyway, Michelle invited me to go to this opera that I'd never heard of by a composer that I'd never heard of. It was Peter Grimes by this guy named Benjamin Britten. And, you know, as a music student, you would think that I would have some passing understanding of who the important composers were, but I had never heard of Benjamin Britten. And so I went because I had a crush on Michelle at the time. And we went and saw this opera, and I can still remember sort of at least the general area in the auditorium where I sat. I can still remember things about the set. I can still remember the moment when, in the third act of that opera, when these people who are running around looking for this fisherman named Peter Grimes, they come running toward the front of the stage and scream his name out into the audience three times because they want to kill him. And it scared the shit out of me, and I'd never had that experience in a live theatrical context. And that's sort of what got me interested in opera. Well, you know, so I had this profound experience that most people don't have the benefit of having, either because they saw the wrong opera or saw the wrong production, or at least out here in Montana, they didn't see an opera at all. Because, you know, the music school does one opera, and they usually choose a light one every 2 years. And other than that, they do little scenes from the operas and that kind of thing. And the programs are always good, but it's hard to really get a sense of what opera's about, or much less get a sense of, you know, why anybody would really care about this stuff if you don't already care about it. And so as this opera company has come together, and as we've been looking toward how we're going to fill auditoriums for performances of two different operas in two different locations this summer, we have kind of come around to the realization that if we're going to fill those seats, it's not going to be with the people who already love opera.
Sure.
Because, of course, there's very few of those people around here. So we're having these parties. So I'm having a party, and I'm trying to get all my friends from the rock and roll scene to just, you know, give me the benefit of the doubt and come and see this singer sing and, you know, drink a bunch of our PBR and get a very warm feeling inside, which is mostly created by the alcohol. And think, you know, I should come to those operas this summer and give it a chance.
Yeah. So, what is the singer going to sing?
I don't know entirely yet. She has a rehearsal tomorrow where she's going to figure out which of the pieces she knows that the pianist feels comfortable with. But she has indicated that she's going to try to sing, or at least she would like to sing, a very famous aria from Puccini's La Rondine. I pronounce that really poorly, but it's a kind of lame opera with one really, really awesome aria in it. And she's going to sing something from Porgy and Bess, I think, and then this lullaby by Dvorak that she sang at a recital recently, and my wife and I really loved it, and since she's coming over and singing at our house, she said she would sing it again.
Well, that's nice.
Yeah. But I need to work on my Italian, by the way.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe you should make a trip to Italy.
Yeah. Well, we actually have an event coming up at two different bars in Missoula and Whitefish, Montana, that we've done a couple of these already, and this is the third one now, called Opera on Draft, and it's also sponsored by PBR, where we have several opera singers come and sing a bunch of arias while people get drunk. This particular iteration of Opera on Draft, we always have a theme. So, like, the first one was 100 bottles of beer on the wall and other operatic classics. The second one was the 7 deadly sins, including opera. And this one is learn to sing Italian in 5 beers or less. So,
you know, I almost did that tonight because, like I said, I started out with some Campari and soda, then I had an Italian beer, and then
you've been all over Italy.
Yeah, after dinner I had the Italian liqueur, but I got to tell you that Italian beer. Since we've been talking about beer and Italy, I got to tell you the Italian beer, the Peroni. It comes in a green bottle. Have you ever noticed anything about beer that comes in a green bottle?
Rolling Rock.
Yeah, but have you ever noticed any characteristic that tends to assert itself about such beers?
It looks like tea.
Well, foreign beers, I would say, especially foreign beers in green bottles.
Yeah, I guess no.
Tend to taste a little skunky sometimes.
Ah. Kind of like Rolling Rock.
Well, really, yeah, it's been so long since I've had a Rolling Rock. Jesus Christ. I don't really understand what the deal is with that beer. Or PBR, for that matter. But, you know, God forbid that I say anything negative about a beer that obviously is supporting the arts there. That's pretty cool. And actually, I've got to say, you know, people around here seem to enjoy drinking Patch of the Ribbon, like the hipsters and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
They seem to enjoy drinking it with a sense of ironic detachment.
Yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's fantastic.
Well, you know, I think that the best marketing ever for PBR was possibly that line in
Blue Velvet.
Oh, God, what was the movie called?
Blue Velvet.
Blue Velvet, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. What's his name? Hopper.
Yeah.
No, absolutely. Perhaps. Pabst Blue Ribbon, man.
Fuck Heineken. Pabst Blue Ribbon.
Yeah, well, Heineken is an example of that, the foreign beer in the green bottle that tastes kind of skunky.
Yeah, yeah. Well, but except Heineken isn't a foreign beer. It's just a foreign named beer made distributed by a domestic beer company.
Well, maybe. What? But it's brewed overseas, isn't it?
Well, I shouldn't talk out of my element, but I don't think so. Well, it might be brewed overseas, but I mean it's distributed by either Budweiser or Miller or one of the big.
Yeah, sure. But all of those companies have to get an American distributor. Okay, so the point is that green glass, I think, is not a good glass to store beer in.
That's an interesting theory you've got there. What do you think about hard alcohols that come in plastic bottles?
I'm all for it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not familiar. Well, hard alcohol in a plastic bottle. Yeah, I guess I've seen that. I'm looking at my bar now, and I don't see any here. So,
really, you're more of a glass bottle guy?
Well, that's what I'm seeing is all glass bottles. And I do kind of dislike plastic as a rule. It's so ubiquitous in our lives these days, you know.
So plasticine.
It's worrisome.
Yeah.
But I don't want to change gears too abruptly, but I just wanted to share with you that I have a letter here from my my Aunt Ron, Ron. Well, it's short for Veronica.
Oh. Okay.
Veronica,
yeah.
Hold on a second. Let me
this isn't a transvestite or anything. What am I holding on for?
All right, I'm back.
Confused.
All right.
Oh, okay. What was I holding on for?
I had to grab this letter.
Oh, gotcha.
Okay, so she wrote
or
me a letter.
Or something.
And, you know, she said that, you know, it was actually a package. It had some presents for Persephone, our daughter,
mm-hmm.
for her first birthday. And then there's this little handwritten letter. You know, she says she's reading my blog now. She'd love to come to New Orleans and visit and get the grand tour like Erky and Riley did, and so forth. And just that she always likes finding out what's going on in my life and that, you know, I'm very talented and I should write a book someday and so forth. She's
mm-hmm.
a very sweet lady and always very, very nice to me. Not that I don't know her that well, because, you know, she lives kind of far away and so forth. But, you know, she's my aunt. And then she goes on, just some unsolicited advice. Take it kindly from your old blood relative aunt who only means well. Please throw out the tarot cards and don't let the baby touch them. The devil works his wiles to lure everyone to him. And as a Lutheran, and maybe you remember in the Bible about not turning to sorcery or witches or star horoscopes, etc. Also, hope you have Persephone baptized and give her the opportunity of going to Sunday school and church like you did, maybe even a Christian school. And then she also says, I see too many young people who have no idea about what the Bible says or even how to attend a church. And so forth, and then some other stuff
mm-hmm.
that I probably shouldn't even read, even on this podcast that very few people listen to. But and you know, I love my nephew and his wife and baby Aunt Ron. So a very sweet letter.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I want to reply back to her and kind of say thank you, of course, for the clothes, and but also thank you for the caring enough to say these things.
Mm-hmm.
And but I just want to reassure her a little bit. And I'm just not sure exactly how to do that without writing a freaking thesis about it. You know, how to, in a succinct way, what are the key notes to hit? I mean, you know, we had it's kind of a baptism of sorts
mm-hmm.
for our daughter. It wasn't a Christian ritual, but...
But there were no swastikas or pentagrams either, right?
There were no swastikas or pentagrams. That's true.
Right. So, you know, you're at least in the middling ground.
I guess so, yes, yes, yes. I mean, I guess what I'm hoping to convey to her is that our daughter, if my wishes are fulfilled, I suppose, will not grow up ignorant of Christianity and church and so forth. I want her to know what that is and what those, you know, what church is and so forth. But I want her to have a broad global perspective.
Sure.
I would like her to actually know about a variety of religions and religious experiences and so forth and what that might mean to people and so forth. So I guess I would say kind of that I'm coming at it from a post-Christian perspective. If you see what I mean. I mean,
well, yeah. I mean, yeah.
That's the religion
not
that I'm speaking.
After Christianity is dead, because of course it's not, but more pantheistic, encompassing, aware perspective.
Yeah, of course, pantheism implies that God is in everything, that all things are God.
Yeah.
Doctrine.
A little confusing.
Yeah, but I guess what I mean by post-Christian is that Christianity is the religion with which I am most familiar. And so, but I don't, not considering myself particularly a Christian anymore, and yet not wanting to emphasize a kind of a hostility to Christianity or, you know, not putting a rejection of Christianity at the center of my thought.
Yeah.
On these matters.
Well, it's you know, you're touching on a troubling thing in a lot of communications and relations, because, you know, there are certain things that different people feel strongly about. Religion is one that that sort of banks on a certain surety that even, you know, I perhaps because we were talking about the opera company, you know, my mind goes back to people who think that classical music is the only and greatest form of music. And, you know, I encounter such people often. And in my line of work, of course, because I write about music every day, and you know, I have a hard time, you know, establishing with people that I recognize the greatness of classical music and all of the great things that it offers, but I don't think that one really gets a rounded perspective about the world. And I don't think that the only astounding musical moments exist in classical music. And, you know, the same thing can be said of Christianity or any form of religion. You know, there's beautiful stories and metaphors and ideas in Christianity that I think are very important to our culture and to preserve. And I think that you and I share this perspective. It's part of why we have kept in touch and continue to be good friends all these years. So I don't need to explain it to you. But so more to the point, though, how do you go about explaining to someone that you recognize those great things in their particular religious persuasion, but without committing yourself to saying, yes, you're right, Persephone will only study the Bible. But I think that, you know, ultimately the most profitable direction to take a stab at answering that question is to be honest and direct about it, that, you know, you plan to educate her and expose her to these things, but that you won't do that to the exclusion of other ideas.
Yeah, of which, you know, tarot cards and stuff is some of the other ideas that are out there.
Yeah.
I think what I feel most, in terms of, you know, what I don't believe, what I think is dangerous and what I want to reject,
mm-hmm.
is the belief that any particular belief is the only belief.
Right. And obviously by starting out that point by saying that there are dangers to tarot card reading and witchcraft and whatnot, she is basically telling you that it's not just that you should expose your child to this stuff, but that it should be the one way. At least that's how it sounds.
No, absolutely. It flows out of the doctrine of the church in which she and I both were raised, which is one, you know, if you think about it in the marketplace of ideas, what ideas are going to succeed over the course of a lifetime, or the course of many generations, or millennia even, I think those ideas that you know, teach this idea must be adhered to the exclusion of others. And you can't listen to those other schools of thought because they're evil. You know, the exclusivity of one particular ideology is successful. It's going to propagate more successfully in the marketplace of ideas. And also the idea that, you know, if you don't believe this, the consequences are dire.
Right.
That this is not just dire, but beyond dire, that they're the ultimate consequences. You know, you're going to burn in hell forever, that kind of thing, if you don't believe this.
Mm-hmm.
Over the course of lifetimes, if people believe and start to buy into those kind of things, those are the ideas that are going to succeed. And I find that extremely pernicious.
Yeah.
So anyway, but I don't think I need to expand on that with my aunt Ron.
Well, you know, and that's, you know, there are all those subtleties of, you know, understanding how to express yourself clearly as far as your own beliefs, and then there's the question of how much do you really need to tell this particular person? You know, if she is not close to you and is saying this stuff out of a sense of just, you know, kind of helpful advice, like don't go into the water for 20 minutes after eating, then, you know, you could sort of respond in kind in a way and simply say that, yes, your daughter will be exposed to Christian ideals and literature, because that's true.
Yeah,
it's an incomplete truth. It's a convenient truth. You know, if you feel like trying to deepen the dialogue, then it gets tricky and challenging. And I guess I don't know quite how to guide you, except to say that one of the things that was coming to my mind when you were talking before was the difference between teaching and indoctrination. And I don't know if that's something that would resonate with this aunt, but certainly, you know, I would, as a parent, even if I had a strong feeling that I wanted to tell my relative that they needed to, you know, share with their child. If the response came back to me that, you know, I agree with you, I think this is an important idea, but I'm going to approach my child rearing as a teaching effort about, you know, the world and all of the ideas and information in the world, rather than an indoctrination of a specific mindset, you know, that would resonate for me. There's probably a lot of people who, for whom that wouldn't resonate.
Well, yes. And you know, another confounding thing here is I don't even know how to pronounce the word aunt or aunt. I always feel kind of torn between.
Oh, yeah, well.
Because an ant, of course, is kind of like an insect, but that is how I was raised, you know, is to say ant.
Yeah, but, I think ant is really how everybody says it.
Well, no, in the Midwest, you're right, but aunt is how people say it down here.
And oh, really?
Auntie.
Did
yeah,
you
oh,
say
absolutely.
It?
Yeah, in the southern, yes.
What the fuck is wrong with those people?
Well, if you think about it, it's more how it's spelled, and actually what's common in down here is you hear auntie. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. What I was wondering was, have you perhaps experienced anything similar with regard to your son and your raising of him?
No. No, actually, I have not actually had anybody go so far as to reach out and offer me any specific advice. I mean, I think my mom probably has, but it's been, you know, very kindly couched and very practical. You know, certainly there's never been any discussion about his spiritual upbringing or those kinds of things. But, you know, then again, I haven't put out on my blog that I'm, doing tarot readings or engaging in anything that would possibly, you know, make it seem like I needed to be set straight.
Ah, yes.
Yeah.
So have you done any tarot readings with Jules?
No, I've never actually had any kind of tarot reading done whatsoever.
No. But
it's
you
just,
did take him to his first movie tonight, so you weren't afraid to duct him into the cult of Hollywood.
Yeah, exactly. And he was, it went well, I would say.
And the movie was Aliens versus Monsters, Monsters versus Aliens?
Right, Monsters versus Aliens, I think is what it was called. And it was in 3D, which was a real revelation. It was a great thing to see how they've transformed this technology and made it.
Do you have to wear glasses? Or?
Yeah, but there are different type of glasses. You can't even look at the glasses and see any difference between the two lenses or anything.
They're kind of gray.
Yeah, they're just both kind of gray. I think they're polarized in different directions or something like that.
They make them in child size?
They don't. But he got into the movie for free because he's under three, and they even gave him his own pair of glasses, which he wouldn't wear. And so, you know, he was basically just watching a blurry movie. And he was pretty enthralled for quite a while. As a matter of fact, there was this, I don't know if it was actually a preview or just kind of a little short at the beginning that was an animated thing involving the squirrel from Ice Age. And he thought that was just hilarious. He was cracking up and clapping and stuff like that. It was really adorable. And he actually sat through, I would say, you know, it's probably, I'm just guessing here, maybe a 90-minute movie, and he sat through maybe 20 minutes of it and started to get a little restless, and I think heard people eating popcorn or saw it or something, so he wanted some popcorn. And so my mom went out and got him some popcorn. And
what's your mom's
that? Name? Yeah, yeah. She came for a kind of surprise visit. And
you didn't know she was coming?
Well, she, I guess not surprised, just last minute. You know, last Friday,
yeah.
she suggested that Daylin should come down for, this is spring break here in Missoula, for the University of Montana. And she suggested to Daylin that she should come down for the week.
Yeah.
And Daylin couldn't, because so much has been happening this week. Gosh, there's all sorts of stories. Daylin couldn't come down because one of her best friends was about to have a baby, and she was afraid it would happen this week, and so she didn't want to leave her high and dry. So we suggested to Mom that she should come here instead, and she did. And then, sure enough, last night, this friend had a baby, and Daylin was actually there, in the room even, for the birth.
Wow.
So, because it was a home birth. So she's had a really intense last 24 hours. So that's completely off the subject, though. Jules really liked the movie, and he liked the popcorn.
And your mom was in there somehow.
Yeah, yeah. And he got a little antsy toward the end and wanted to walk up and down the stairs, but that was okay. Mom kind of walked up and down the stairs with him, and they watched the rest of the movie, and it was a good movie.
And for the test. Well,
the
awesome.
Monsters won.
I was shooting some video of Persephone the other day, yesterday, and I turned the camera around and played back some of the video and let her look at the viewfinder.
Mm-hmm.
She was
utterly
enthralled.
Utterly
enthralled by that little viewfinder. And so it was clear, you know, I mean, just even a month ago, I don't think she would have paid too much attention to the viewfinder.
Yeah.
So that was, I felt like a you know, kind of big cognitive development. And also, I think she's starting to sometimes repeat words back to us now. So.
Yeah. Or attempt them anyway. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. They're very. What do you call it? They don't very much resemble the words that we say.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
And as long as we're just kind of free associating. I just wanted to mention that I thought of a band from the late 70s, early 80s that I just hadn't thought of for a good decade, which is Triumph. Do you remember
Triumph? Yeah.
You do?
Yeah, I remember Triumph.
And so what was a hit that Triumph had? Can you name it?
Oh, fuck.
Tell me anything about Triumph.
You know... I remember that they had really, really, really carefully manicured hair.
Do you remember?
Yeah, yeah. Well, they were on the very much pop side of, you know, hard rock in the early 80s. So,
That's correct.
As I recall, you know, my association at the time was that they were trying to be a much more accessible, pop-oriented version of even like Rush or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
So it was,
now,
yeah.
Very well done. They were constantly throughout their career compared to and in the shadow of Rush. Because they were a Canadian power trio, and of course, there's only one other Canadian power trio, and that's Rush.
Yeah.
And, but you don't remember any of their hits, huh?
Not by name. Although, as soon as you say the name of one, it will flood my consciousness, and I'll probably want to kill you.
Yes. Well, Magic Power, of course, is probably the most popular, most recognized song.
Magic Power.
Magic
I don't remember
Power.
By name.
She's young now, she's wild now, she wants to be free. She's got
God.
The magic power over music.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a horrible thing. Yeah, exactly.
But the song that I kind of liked most, I think, was what was it called? Fight the Good Fight.
Yeah, I remember that one actually.
Which I can't even sing because it has to be done in kind of a Geddy Lee-esque falsetto.
Yeah.
Again, the Rush comparison.
Right. Exactly.
And I had totally forgotten about that band.
Yeah, for good reason.
Well, perhaps. Mm. Yeah, they're really not the high mark of quality, I suppose.
Yeah.
Well, we have ventured far afield here.
Yeah, it seems so. Yet have really
gone nowhere.
Achieved nothing. Yeah.
Gone nowhere and achieved nothing.
Yeah.
That's pretty much it.
Exactly.
I had a revelation today that what I do for a living is essentially play. Because I work in faculty development, and you know, play is a crucial part of development for children, and also for really education. And anyone who's developing needs to play.
Right.
And if you're business development, then you need to cultivate a sense of play, and that's why I love my job.
Wow. Well, that's good for you.
On the other hand, you are a writer, and writing is a creative act, and in creation, you have to maintain a sense of play to be good at what you do.
Yeah.
But as I observed, it takes a long time to get there.
Yeah. Yeah. I would say that's true. You know, the sense of play is, the messing around with words is the part of my job that I really appreciate and love and wish that I could just do all day long.
Yeah. All those other
but
parts.
There's, yeah. What's that?
It's all those other parts.
Yeah, exactly.
Including those damn stuffed shirts.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Well, what can you do?
Right. Exactly. So we've probably been talking for about 2 hours now.
Well, almost. It's coming up on 50 minutes.
Oh, well, there we go. So have you, do you feel like you've gained any insight from this month of sobriety that has come to a crashing end?
Not much, except that, not really.
Did you give up caffeine?
Yes. There is one thing. I must not be an alcoholic, because if I was an alcoholic, surely I couldn't just stop drinking for 36 days.
Right on. Yeah.
Right?
Well,
sure. You agree with.
Yeah, I'm absolutely in agreement.
But, seriously, I mean, that's one reason that I do things like that, is just to check myself and make sure that I don't have, because if I did have, I feel like if I had what I felt was a debilitating dependency, then I would, take steps. So
right.
Whatever that might be. I'm not really sure. But we hear a lot about detoxing, and you hear a lot about that. I'm not sure exactly what I mean, but I guess not drinking or doing anything incredibly psychoactive for 36 days might qualify as detoxing. What you don't hear a lot about is retoxing, which is getting back into the swing of drinking and alcohol and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that deserves a little bit more attention. But in all seriousness, I do recognize that there's a significant percentage of the population, maybe a minority, but still a significant percentage, that just can't handle, the ubiquity of alcohol and drinking and so forth, and that this becomes extremely problematic for those people, and that they at some point have to just say, you know what, I just can't drink anymore, and I should not drink and so forth. And if I was to come to that stage in my life where that, if alcohol was to be a problem and I had to stop drinking, I obviously, if that was the case, then I wouldn't be saying, well, I could do it, because I would be having that would be part of the problem. But I guess what I'm saying is that not drinking for a while and just taking a break from it and so forth gives me an opportunity to reflect on whether or not, you know, what is my relationship with substances and so forth, because I don't want to be in an abusive pattern of behavior.
Right.
Whether
exactly.
It's alcohol or any other drug. And so I feel it's extremely important to have that sense of freedom. And if I didn't have that sense of freedom, then I would say I've got to take extra steps to make sure that I do, that my freedom isn't impeded, my liberty isn't impeded by any kind of substance dependency.
That's a very eloquent way of putting it.
I don't feel very eloquent, but anyway. Thank you. And I only say that as a testimony to where I'm at personally and so forth. But, I do have a concern for any individuals with whom I have Congress, including you.
Yeah.
I would recommend this procedure to anyone and everyone. Take a break every now and then and see what the soul does there.
Yeah. It's been a little over a year since I did this, but at the beginning of last calendar year, I took a month and didn't drink, and it was, it was slightly less entertaining, I suppose, or, entertaining in the moment at the time. But, it went fine. So, I didn't die.
That must have been shortly after your son was born.
No, this was actually about around his 9-month birthday or so.
How old is he now?
He's going to be 2 in like 3 weeks.
Well, he's a little older than I thought.
Yeah.
Well, congratulations.
Yeah, well, thanks. He's fun and hilarious to have around.
I'm sure that he is. Is he still cursing up the storm?
No, he, since that night, there's been a little bit of a lull in his foul mouth behavior.
Yeah.
And so, we're hoping that will continue.
Lull before the storm, I'm sure.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, well, Jay, it's been good talking to you, as always. The best to you and Daylin and Jules, and, of course, your mother. You got to give your mother my love because she's there.
Exactly. Well, and same to you down in NOLA. Till the wee one and considering
weird.
That you're so much taller than your wife, you may not know that I refer to your child as the wee one.
We went into the daycare the other day. Usually it's either one or the other of us, but we both went in at the same time the other day, and they just burst into laughter, the adults.
Yeah, it's fairly noticeable.
Yeah. I'm tall and she's not.
Yeah. But she has other qualities that endear her to the people.
We can't talk about those.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, we'll get arrested. Okay.
Yeah.
So thank you very much, and have a good one.
Yeah, you too, and we'll talk soon, Barry.
Yeah, in a week or two.
Yep. Later on.